to everyone. I hope all of you can hear me okay. We thumbs up? All right. You please be patient with me. This is my first cyber sermon, so we'll see how this goes. Well, let's start off with a well-worn question. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound? So those of you that are on the side of it makes a sound, raise your hand. Let's see. Okay, so we have our scientific objectivists there. Good. Those of you that say it does not make a sound, no one's there to hear it, raise your hand. Do we have any good old worn postmodernists in here? I'm scanning through. None? Really? Interesting. Well, hold that thought. You know, this question deals with if something happens without someone, no one to perceive it, does it actually happen? We'll return to it. Last week, Carrie started our season of creation with a poem that's actually very dear to me. Wendell Berry's How to Be a Poet has many personal connections in my own life, and it seems appropriate that today I begin with the same poem. If you look at the stanza that she quoted from, there's a couple of rapid-fire commands before Berry claims that there are no unsacred places. I'll read it. Breathe with unconditional breath the unconditioned air. Shun electric wire. Communicate slowly. Live a three-dimensioned life. Stay away from screens. Stay away from anything that obscures the place it is in. There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. Barry says, shun electric wire. Stay away from screens. Stay away from anything that obscures the place it is in. This week's focus within our season of creation is land. And today I would ask you to consider Barry's injunction to, quote, stay away from anything that obscures the place it is in. Now, I'm afraid I'm going to roam to many places today, so let me just go ahead and provide my end goal at the very beginning. Here are my intentions. Are you ready? We must relearn how to become pagans. Animists who see the world as a landscape full of persons, both human and non-human. Everything around us is embodied. From the electron to the four-legged animal to the rooted tree, everything is an embodied landscape of personhood. All bodies are lands. All bodies are selves. Therefore, all lands are persons. Bodies should not and cannot be owned, exploited, raped, dismembered. Bodies can only be held in relation to other bodies. Therefore, we cannot own anything, but only be held in relation to other bodies. Our Western cultural and economic heritage is a story of reaching for domination instead of partnership. And with domination comes objectification. We stopped looking at the world as a creation full of persons and only saw mindless machinery ready for our manipulation. We left Eden, an ecology of selves, and entered a land empty of persons. And I believe in our loneliness we have pillaged Mother Earth and all her creatures, including ourselves. All right, that was actually where I'm going. It took me a while to get there, didn't it? Our main biblical text today that I want to focus on is a whopper. The string of curses in Genesis, really? This is what I get assigned? Let's recap. There's a tree of knowledge of good and evil. Then there's this serpent. And the serpent's like, hey, Eve, let's have some of this fruit. Eve's like, sounds kind of good. Hey, Adam, let's eat this. We're going to get some knowledge. We're going to be like God. So they do. And what happens? Oh, crap, we're naked. We get expelled. There's gender domination. This whole cascade of curses, right? Expulsion, gender domination, enmity with the serpent, thorns and thistles. And of course, this is followed by fratricide. Cain kills Abel. Cain is marked and wanders the earth for the rest of his days. Now, this origin myth is complex. And I should note that this mythic narrative has been used to legitimate patriarchal society, to sanctify structural racism, to normalize enmity with the earth and to so thoroughly denigrate humanity into total depravity that some theologians would feel required to argue that infants who died prematurely would go to hell without baptism. So why in the hell am I preaching on this passage? This myth is a doozy. And it seems to suggest, like quantum string theory, a theory for everything. To be sure, the curse of Cain does not belong to the enslaved black bodies of American history. Rather, white Christian European settlers are the descendants of Cain, and these are my ancestors, and of many who hear my words today. After all, it was early American white settlers who murdered their native siblings. And many of us today bear the weight of a cursed culture that cannot commit to land, but must forever wander the world homeless. To be sure, the curse of Eve still sits in our patriarchal lands, where male white supremacy is the inner logic of social hierarchy and power distribution. And to be sure, like the borderlands of Eden, full of thorn and thistle, our lands are dying and drying. Full of fire, weed, and desecrated soil. And these are all worthy topics, worthy sermons to be said, but today I'd like to ask a question that my 16-year-old self has asked for many years. How in the world did Adam and Eve not realize they were naked? Oh, you may laugh. A friend of mine years ago was asked to read the passage in Genesis 3:7, and here's the quote. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew they were naked. Now, when my friend approached the word naked, he threw all of his Arkansan dialect into it. And they knew that they were naked. The dramatic pause was enough to raise more than a few eyebrows, and it was quite some time before he was asked to read scripture again. Now, I know it will take more than that to mortify this liberal crowd I'm speaking to today. It did cross my mind that I could actually get away with preaching naked today without getting arrested. But I didn't want to scar my children. So here I am, fully clothed, asking, what happened in their way of seeing? How did Adam and Eve's perception change? What does nakedness even mean if you've never worn clothes? Why does Eden disappear when Adam and Eve realize they are buck naked? Of course, we're playing with myth here, right? So we must investigate this beyond the literal. There is a subtle shift in how Adam and Eve experienced the world pre- and post-naked awareness. This shift may tell us something about what it means to live in a, quote, fallen world. Before reaching for the fruit, here are some points to remember. Eden is full of partners who are created from the same substrate. Adama is the Hebrew word. It's by which humans are created. It is humus. It is soil. And there are other creatures around that are created from that same spot, that same place. Two, humans are given the task to name all creatures. This is an intimate act of communication. For an ancient perspective, this is to be in communication with the world. Three, communion with God in this pre-moment is interwoven in their existence, again through relational experience. And what happens after? After reaching for the fruit, we have patriarchy, we have expulsion from Eden, we have naked shame, and we have violence. This shift is initiated by a voice that despises our creaturely status and lusts for godlike control. Eat. You will not die. You will be like God. This desire consumed Adam and Eve, and from it they and we consumed the world for ourselves. From this act, we have partitioned ourselves from the rest of creation. We have seen ourselves as naked. The story of civilization is a story of humans who see themselves as naked and work to clothe themselves. We reject our creaturely status and separate ourselves from an ecology of persons. And the result is disastrous. We obscure the place we are in, and as Wendell Berry says, quote, that is why subduing the things of nature to human purposes is so dangerous, and why it so often results in evil, in separation, and desecration. A year ago, my family and I found ourselves hiking in an old-growth trail in Washington called Grove of the Patriarchs. Thanks to Carrie's suggestion, actually, we had decided to briefly explore this area before we finished our travels towards the western coast. On this day, the trail was fairly crowded with other fellow two-legged humans, and as we entered the grove, peopled with massive individuals called hemlock, red cedar, and Douglas fir, there was a silence that percolated into the crowd. It was my first time to be in the company of such ancient persons, such ancient trees, and I personally was overwhelmed. The silence, however, was pierced by a man's voice behind me who said, "Can you imagine the house you could build with one of these trees?" And just like that, the magic, the communication, the Eden-like moment was lost, and I mourned, and I grumbled, and I wept for the rest of that hike. Maybe now we can return to that initial question. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound? Do you see the hubris in the question itself? It assumes that there are no persons outside of human personhood to experience the falling of a tree in a forest. And this hubris moves us to think that nothing exists except for our own perception. This is an unholy existential nakedness. We often use the language of dehumanization to refer to behavior and ways of perceiving that objectify other humans. Perhaps we should extend this notion. Our military, industrial, economic way of life depersonalizes all persons, all bodies, all land. Let me close with one final idea. I've been mourning the untimely death of one of my intellectual and activist heroes, the anarchist anthropologist David Graeber. He was a giant in the anarchist community and a leader for egalitarian politics during the Occupy movement. His seminal work will probably be known as Debt, the massive book that looks over the history of our notions of debt. But one of my favorite essays was published in The Baffler a few years ago, and it's called What's the Point If We Can't Have Fun? The essay is a far-reaching exploration of consciousness beyond the human. In the essay, Graeber asks, can electrons have some form of personhood, of agency? And his answer is yes. Why does this seem so crazy and unscientific to our modern ears? Graeber notes that if we see the world through a kind of Darwinian self-interest commercialized by our capitalism, then personhood is merely a mirage for a deeper inanimate violence. But if, and here is where I quote, if an electron is acting freely, if it, as Richard Feynman is supposed to have said, does anything it likes, it can only be acting freely as an end in itself, which would mean that at the very foundations of physical reality, we encounter freedom for its own sake. Which also means we encounter the most rudimentary play, end quote. It is no accident that Eden means delight. Perhaps when we strip our perception that obscures our place in the world, perhaps when we get naked once more, we will come back into relationship with a world full of persons. Perhaps when we allow the naked landscape of our bodies to intimately communicate with the body of creation, we will also learn to hear God again. Surely that will be a life best described as one of playful delight. In the meantime, a change in my perception won't stop the fires. the human-made apocalypse at hand. But it would seem we will have to learn to mourn before we learn how to delight again in the world. After all, when our relatives, those that we have a relationship with, are sick, we sit at their bedside. We hold their hands. We tell them stories. We sing to them. We remind them of their beauty and place in our lives. Should we not do the same for our mother? For our neighbors who are more than human? Perhaps in our mourning, we will learn to hear their voices again and realize we never actually left Eden.
Our service continues with the liturgical affirmation of faith. You, O God, are supreme and holy. You create our world and give us life. Your purpose overarching